Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today I have two guests. First time, Professor Dorit Naaman. She's the professor of films and media at Queen's University in Canada, and she's also the director of the project Jerusalem, We Are Here, which is a series of walking tour of Katamon. And I just want to mention that a previous guest, Mona Halabi, is also a contributor to this project. And the second guest of the podcast today is Marina Parinosu, Parisinu, author of blog My Palestinian Story, but also associate producer of Jerusalem, We Are Here. To Dorit and Marina, welcome.
Thank you for having
us. I will start with Dorit. And as you know, there's only one question, the same question that I asked to all of my guests. Dorit, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
From my father's side, I'm a sixth generation Jerusalemite. My family came to Jerusalem from Hungary in the middle of the 19th century, well before Zionism. And they were ultra-Orthodox Jews that eventually became more modern Orthodox Jews. And my great-grandfather was a member of the first Knesset, which was a very radical shift and a kind of a rebellion against his own heritage and origins. My father was an atheist always. He did not believe in God and raised me atheist in Jerusalem, which sounds like an oxymoron, but really it's not. In fact, Jerusalem is a very good place to grow up atheist because you have three prominent religions and so many sects, and you can experience it as a kind of a comparative religious experience rather than there's one way and there are minorities, as I experience it in Canada. So Jerusalem, my mother was also born in Jerusalem and mostly raised on and off there, but lived all her adult life in Jerusalem. So to me, Jerusalem is home, even though it has changed drastically in the years I have not been living there full time.
Marina, same question. What is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
Jerusalem is the place my mother called home. It's the place where my great-great-great-grandfather Georges Dakhliv, emigrated to from the Balkans along with his brother in the mid-1800s, and where four generations of Dakhlivs built their lives. They married, they had children, they went to school, they worked, they played. It's the place where my grandfather moved to from the Greek island of Samos, and where he met my Dakhliv grandmother and built a family. So it's a place first of convergence of different people where they mixed and coexisted. And then it became a place of dispersion. It's the place they lost in 1948. And it became the place about which they told stories. And there was a lot of nostalgia in the stories, but also a lot of joy, because their lives were rich and full and joyful in Jerusalem. So the stories drew me in, and I couldn't get enough of them. And I started collecting them. And later, when years later, I got involved with the Jerusalem We Are Here project and started my own blog, my work on those stories became more methodical, more systematic. I started visiting Jerusalem regularly, and I was able to see firsthand where all those stories took place. And the memories, my family's memories, which I've essentially inherited, they've become my own, they came face to face with reality. And from that point, Jerusalem became like those old black and white photographs that get re-photographed, where you take the same frame, same angle, and then you partially superimpose the black and white on the colored. So the black and white, the old black and white represents the abstract, the faded memory, and the emotional imprint. And the colored one is the more modern, it's the reality, which is, it's grittier and harsher. So that's my Jerusalem. It's a collage of old and new, of family stories and real history, and the connections I have made in the process of exploring that.
Marina, I want to ask you something, because you mentioned something very important. You talked about joyful memories. When we look at Jerusalem 2021, there's not much joyful going on. I mean, between demonstrations, appropriations, political struggles, and so forth. To hear stories that are different, to hear about joyful stories, is something refreshing. So I was wondering, would you be able to share some of those with us just briefly?
Well, the stories my family told was about their everyday life. And in fact, the more I read about history, the more I am perplexed by it as well, because having learned that they lived through, you know, the Arab Revolt, the World War II, the Nakba, but those are not, I mean, even though they were always mentioned, the focus was always on the day-to-day stuff, even in the hard times. For example, my mother told me that they had the best time during World War II. Why? Because a lot of Greek officers were posted in Jerusalem. So the Greek girls of the Greek colony were having a ball with them. They were hosting them for lunches. My grandmother was supposed to, she was hosting lunch every Sunday, and they would always have a Greek officer. So the young girls were excited about that. Also, my great uncle's, my grandmother's brother's cinema, The Regent. They always talked about The Regent. He owned The Regent Cinema in the German colony. So it was all about The Regent and what they saw there. And then their dances at the Greek club and their parties. I mean, it was as if nothing else was happening around them. And now that I read history, I beat myself up for not having read it while they were still alive, and I could ask them how they reconciled the two.
And I think this is one of the fascinating aspects of integrating these stories into the sort of the official narratives. We lost the sense of what was daily lives, and we just think that everybody was involved in some form of a struggle, but actually people had interactions, something that obviously in the last 20 years has been denied because of the war, because of the lack of communication. So things are very different nowadays, but there were avenues for people to meet and keep working together just beyond just the politics, and as you mentioned, the Arab revolt. Dorit, do you have stories too that you want to share about your family?
Yes, I think that Jerusalem until 1948 was a very different city that we know it now. So my great-grandmother, for instance, spoke two languages. They were Yiddish and Arabic. She didn't speak Hebrew. Hebrew was the language that came much later, but the languages that she needed for her day-to-day were Yiddish and Arabic. And life was so integrated that Arabic was absolutely essential. Her husband, my great-grandfather, co-owned a grocery store, a vegetable stall, I'm not exactly sure, near Me'ah She'arim until 1929. So, and in fact, when my grandmother was married, we still have a beautiful set for coffee, like the finjans, the little glasses, and all this copper that is very beautifully engraved that he gifted my grandmother. So it was relationships that were beyond business relationship. Those were relationships of friendship and of integration. And I think even later on, when my father was a young a teenager in the 1940s, he had a very close friend who was a Palestinian boy named Ishaq. My father's name was Isaac Itzhak, so they had the same name. My father had a dog, he had a dog, and they were absolutely friends, even though this Ishaq was in the Najada and my father was associated with the Haganah. And so there was a personal, like Marina said, there was a personal, and then there were the larger events, and they didn't always mean that there was a separation, or often they didn't until the war. I also don't like, you know, we talk often about East and West Jerusalem, but until 1948, there was no East and West Jerusalem. The neighborhoods were some neighborhoods were mixed, and some neighborhoods were Palestinian only or Jewish only, but they were not necessarily divided along the East-West. That is a result of the 48 war and its aftermath. So it was a very different Jerusalem. When we were doing research for Jerusalem War here, we found out just in the few dozen families that people we have talked to and read about that in Katamon alone, there were multiple couples that were intermarried, Jewish, Christian, Christian Muslim, and Muslim Jewish. And no one was shunned. No one had to deny one identity in order to be part of the multiple communities.
And not only that, communities were not crossing borders as people do nowadays, even though they do not really exist. But you are very much aware of the fact that you're walking in West Jerusalem or East Jerusalem, and you're crossing certain lines, and that's inevitable. Just because you mentioned that, so I guess I want to ask about the project. Dorit, can you tell us what is Jerusalem We Are Here, how this project was born, and what are the goals of this amazing project, which I want to remind the listener, it's available at jerusalemwearehere.com, correct?
Yes, thank you. Jerusalem We Are Here is an interactive documentary that digitally and virtually brings the Palestinians back into the neighborhoods from which they were expelled by the 1948 war. So we're primarily focused on Katamon, but a little bit on the German colony and Baqa and the Greek colony as well. So these are neighborhoods in southern Jerusalem that were primarily Palestinian, and also had a bunch of consulates and embassies and some hotels, lots of cultural life, the Greek club, that was a place where lots of events were taking place. It was a very vibrant community and neighborhoods that were established after the end of the First World War and into the British Mandate over Jerusalem. And basically what happens is when you enter the project, you will enter at the Regent Cinema, which was owned by Marina's great uncle, Nando Stakleff. And from there, you can choose to go on virtual walks. There are three different walks. And in every house where we had participants, we made a film together. So you get to watch short films. And there are about 15 of those and a whole about the same number of audio files of all sorts. Some are more historical, some are more personal, letters read, poetry. And the other side of it is that there is a map of all those neighborhoods where every house that existed before 1948 is a live link. So people can send us information and we upload it on this map. This maps, as everyone knows, I think, are generally produced by states, and states have certain agendas when they create maps, what they show and what they don't show, which layer, which time. It also seems like a flattened representation of space and time. And our map is really generated from the ground up by what we found in archives, by what Mona Halabi collected over many years, by what Anwar Ben Badis collected, what some of the connections Marina has. And since the project has been released in 2016, what people send us, because they find the project and they send us photos and stories and further identifications. So this map is still growing and will likely continue to grow. I'm sure.
Yeah, I wondered, how did the connection between the two of you start?
It started with an email that I received from my aunt in New York, actually Nando Stakloff's daughter, who received it. So the project sent out a call for residents of Katamon or their descendants as they were starting. And this email found itself to my aunt Cynthia, who knew I was the family historian, the one with the bug. So she sent it to me. It was sent to her from Mona Halabi. That was sent to her from, I think, from somebody from Zohrot. It was a chain of connections. And Mona was saying, you know, if you're interested in this project, write to them or write to me and I will forward. And I wrote directly to the project. I explained who I was. At the time I was in Cyprus, I split my year. I spent half my time in Cyprus and I said, I'm in Cyprus at the time, but I live in San Francisco. And I'm, you know, very interested in this. I'm already doing my own research. And then out of courtesy, I copied Mona, who responded straight away. And she said, Marina, I live in Berkeley. So her and I connected. And then when I came back to San Francisco, we started a series of Skype calls with Dorit. Dorit was exploring different, she wanted each participant to have a different angle to their story. It wasn't a strict, you know, tell me the story of your family's Nakba. So we started a series of Skype calls. And then in the summer of 2014, I was going home again to Cyprus, which is just a skip and a hop from Jerusalem. So I suggested that I go over and I met Dorit in person for the first time. She filled me at my grandfather's house or whatever it's become of it. It just went from there. Then the three of us, Mona, Dorit and I, formed a very strong friendship. And it just went from there.
Dorit, the technology of a website looks like you're basically walking through the neighborhood. How did you come up with this idea? Because it makes you feel you're actually walking throughout Katamon. So it's not just about description, it's not a picture, but there is a sense of motion through it.
It's a great question. When I started this project, my parents moved to live in what used to be an old soccer field in Katamon by the British, and then the Hapoel soccer field and became a development and they moved there. And I was visiting for 6 months and I had a 1-year-old child and they rented an apartment for us nearby in what I knew was a Palestinian home, but I didn't quite know anything else about it. And I realized by a fluke that I was living next to Khalil Sakakini's house. And then I found his daughter, Khala Sakakini's memoir. And in it, there was a hand-drawn map with names. So I started there and I thought, what would it be like if we could find some of these people and kind of make some films with them and project them on the houses? But I was also interested in the history of Katamon post-48, which I can talk about maybe later. So to answer your question, what I was imagining initially was that we will make a bunch of films and project them on the houses. It will be an installation, people will come and watch it. And it took me quite a long time to realize how inhospitable that idea was to Palestinians. Even the ones who have access, who don't need to get a permission and get through a checkpoint or their passport, even if they have American passport, they can get into Jerusalem because they have a Hawiya or some other limitation. Even Palestinians in East Jerusalem don't feel comfortable in West Jerusalem. And I had an experience with a participant. We were standing in front of her house and I saw her, I was filming and I saw her body language kind of shrink. And when I looked away from the camera, I realized there was a bylaw officer giving parking tickets. And this person has absolutely no authority over her, but it was a person, a figure of authority of the state and of the city, municipality, and she shrunk, she was worried. And that was a kind of, for me, that was the moment where I realized we can't do this in the space, this is just wrong. This project needs to be available to any Palestinian without checkpoints and passports and having to defend your right to be in the space. So that's how it became, how and why it became online. And then I worked, we worked quite for a long time with a company in Toronto that built the platform. We use Google Street View, their car, as much as possible, and created our own content so that it integrates quite smoothly between the two so that we can introduce our own assets. And we really try to do it very low key. The production, everything was quite as kind of as subtle as possible.
I want to ask you something about, again, sort of the structure of the project. And this is a question for both of you. Essentially, you had to go out mapping the neighborhoods and trying to figure out who were the owners of these houses. What are the challenges? What were the obstacles? How did you go through and navigate through the questions about knowledge and sometimes lack of knowledge? Because as far as I know, a lot of people are not necessarily aware of the fact that they live in previously owned houses by Palestinians. Or they have some knowledge, but they don't really engage with it.
I'll speak about it a little bit, but then I would like Marina to tell the story about the picture, the trying to find. You will know the picture that we were looking for the slope for the house on the slope next to the Abdin Circle, and how we found that house. The archives, interestingly, the Israeli State Archive and Jerusalem Municipality Historical Archive had very little information. And it's curious because the British, when they left their colonies, they tended to leave all the civil material in place. Whether stuff hasn't been cataloged and is still sitting in boxes somewhere or whether it has been destroyed, we don't know, but we got some information through the archives. Primarily, somebody has built an outhouse without getting a permit, and now the municipality is writing a letter that he needs to take it down. But when they say that, they actually list the adjacent properties and who owns them. So that gave us a little bit of information. Talking to Israelis, they generally don't know who owned their houses. And to my surprise, many were actually interested in finding out. I have over the years gotten emails from people who want to know and ask whether we know, whether we have a way to know or a way to connect them with the people when the house is listed on our on the map. You asked about the gaps, and I think that the gaps are incredibly important. They're as important as the houses that we have information for. They represent what happens when people flee at wartime because they don't always take their documents and their photo albums. And so some people just don't have the evidence. Some people have been too traumatized to talk to their kids about it. And by the time their grandchildren started asking questions, There was no one to tell. What we did find that is interesting is that in a few occasions, a younger person, after the project was out, a younger person would take their grandparent on a virtual walking tour, and the grandparent would go like, oh, that's so-and-so's house. Because when you see the houses, they're often changed, their fences, their trees that have grown, the houses went through many transformation, but some of them are still recognizable and there are definitely some landmarks. And then they would say, okay, like Marina was, she got the instruction from the Abdin Square, you go down the street and you know it should be there. She even had a picture and we couldn't find it, and I'll pass it on to Marina to tell this the story of how we found that house.
Right, so before the first trip, when I was going to Jerusalem, I was given instructions to find the house where my grandmother's sister lived, and it's the house where the family, my mother's family, moved to after the bombing of the Semiramis, because the Kasotis house, my grandfather's house, was two doors up from the Semiramis. And when the bombing happened, they and the neighborhood emptied, they moved with the Gaitanopoulos, who were close to the Abdin circle. So my mother gives me instructions, directions. She says, you know, go down the Katifora. Katifora is a word Dorit loves, which means the downhill slope. When you get to the Semiramis, turn left. And I knew where the Semiramis was, so that was fine. And then you take the first ride and you get to Marika's house. And I go there and we're trying to find this. And it was only afterwards that I realized that half the streets that are there now didn't even exist back then, or there were dirt roads. So my mother's first ride after the Semiramis wasn't what is today first ride. And I had a picture that just didn't fit. I had taken, when I first visited with her in 1986, I took one photograph because then I shot film and film was expensive. So I had one single photograph, but I also had some old photographs I found in my mother's archives where she had taken pictures outside the Gaitanopoulos house with her cousins. And there was a house with a round balcony. And we tried, we just drove around Abdin Circle and nothing quite fit. There were a couple with round structures, but they weren't quite right. And I visited the area again and again. And one day I actually went with Mamelo Gaitanopoulos, who's of that family and is actually a well-known musician in Israel. So he drove me around. And one day as he was driving me back to the old city, to my hotel, suddenly it dawned on me that perhaps the photograph I had was printed the wrong way around. So I went to the hotel, I pulled out the photograph, I reversed it on the computer, and suddenly it made more sense. I could see the Luizidis property. So we went back with Mamelo and I'm still looking for it. And then I can see the Luizidis property and I'm sort of trying to navigate through this photograph, which I have on my iPad, and I'm approaching this house next to it. And there's this huge tree and I go behind the tree and suddenly there's the round balcony. And it all made sense. So I knew exactly where my aunt's house was, which was on the other side of the road.
Can I ask you, how did you feel about it when you found your aunt's house there, you know, at a personal level?
Well, because it took so much to get to it, it was like a triumph. It was sort of bingo, here it is. And afterwards, there was a little bit of a anticlimax after that. It was a sort of, so what? Because so much had built up to finding that. But then later on, when I started getting more involved in the family story, then I realized what the value of that is. It's connecting the old with the new. It's connecting all these stories with what's there today and making them more real.
Yeah, I would like to respond to that, to the so what. I think that to me, every time we have an identification, it's both, there is both the heaviness of knowing that people have lost, not only have they lost their homes and their lives as they have known it, and often all their possessions, but but that the knowledge of where it is has been taken away, because streets didn't have street names and all the street names have been changed and the houses have been converted and divided. And so it's very hard, right? So so having an identification, I think, is an important political act, because no matter what the political solution to the, you know, Palestinian-Israeli conflict, there will never be justice and there will never be peace without people's losses being recognized. So that to me is, so that's why I feel it's also a victory. It's, there is a heaviness, but it's also a victory. And I, you know, when we screened the project in Bethlehem, I was asked about the map. I was asked, aren't you worried that this is, people will now know where their houses are and they can go and try to claim them? And I'm not worried about that. I don't think it's the elephant in the room. I don't think until we sort out the dispossession of 48, we will never have stability, and there will never be justice. So we have to start recognizing it before we can imagine even a different future. And the other thing I would say about recognizing, when I screened the project in Washington, D.C., there were two women about my age that started crying throughout. And at that screening, Jamil Tube was with me. He was, at the time, he was 88 or 89, and he flew from Albuquerque to come to meet me in Washington, D.C., and he gave a lot of information to the project. I have a wonderful story, actually, about him trying to help us identify a house and sending me directions. And he said, when you take the number 4, which I knew from Halasakakini, the last stop of the number 4 bus, which I knew where it was, and you turn around and you walk, and then you walk up to here and then you walk left, you know, and you will find it. So he could, from memory, right, years later, so many years later, tell me exactly how to find the house. But anyways, he was there, and I told him, Jamil, you tell me where you want to go and I'll go there. So at one point he asked for the Sakab grocery store, and I couldn't remember. I was hovering over a few houses. When you hover over a house, if it has information, the name flashes and it tells you if there are pictures or if there's more information. And anyway, so what it turned out after the screening, that as I was hovering over these houses, I located the house that belonged to the father of these two women. And between them and another family member, there were 3 or 4 trips to Jerusalem where the father gave instructions and none of them could find the house. And here we were in Washington, D.C., and we found the house, right? So, and that identification came from one of those documents from the British about expanding a road or whatever and letting everyone know that, you know, 2 meters from their property will be taken away or something. So there were enough names to identify a few houses along a stretch of the road. So those things are both important and emotional.
We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
They're emotional indeed. And that's where I want to go next, is the power of emotions. The moment people realize that those houses have been emptied in 1948, and the Palestinians that are able now to find the old places, particularly the younger families, you know, rely on the memory of the great-grandparents or their parents. How did you manage this flow of emotion? What kind of criticism? Because it's easier to see via acclamation. This is a great project. But I'm sure that you also had to deal with criticism, perhaps even on both sides. What was your experience of that?
You know, there was less criticism from the Israeli side than I expected, I have to say. I think that I was, you know, I definitely was expected more hate mail and hateful comments, and there are the occasional ones, but more often than not, there is curiosity, and a lot of Israelis I find are willing to acknowledge the loss of the Palestinians, whether they're willing to take the next step and say, what's my responsibility to remedy that? I'm not sure, right? That depends, that varies greatly. But certainly I have led walks in the neighborhood. I have done an event together with Zohot, the Israeli organization, the only organization in Israel that calls for the right of return of Palestinians. And we did an event where we had three houses that opened their doors to us to install the project in various incarnations. And hundreds of people came over. So it was a kind of open door, open house type event. And a few hundred people came that weekend. And it wasn't always the people you would have thought. And what was amazing was that people recognized that the houses they lost in Europe or in Morocco, and that their parents or grandparents missed, that there was a similarity there, right? And that's a big step. And again, I don't know, you know, equating the situation is not a solution. There are many, many differences, of course, especially between the Second World War and the Nakba in all kinds of ways. I mean, we have participants in the project whose house in Sheikh Jarrah is threatened right now, right? So the Nakba has never ended for them. It's not something of the past. So there are many differences, but just for Israelis to be able to see that, I think is, and be open to that. And I think partially it's because they don't necessarily stand with a Palestinian in the same space, then feeling they need to justify their right to be in the space, or that they need to apologize, or that they need to challenge the Palestinian on their right to the space. So they have time. They watch it online. They watch it in a setup where they have time to process. So the responses have been, by and large, very positive and very curious. Some people have started thinking about putting a sign on their house saying this house belonged to so-and-so, you know. It's not necessarily safe at this moment in Jerusalem to do, but it's interesting that people are considering if there is a way to do that. From the Palestinian side, Marina, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
haven't felt any criticism, nothing negative from the Palestinian side, far from it. Only in a way, gratitude for restoring their past to them and for making their places accessible to them again, albeit digitally. I haven't felt anything, no negative criticism.
Yeah, and I think there are emotional reactions for sure. There are very emotional reactions, and I think that's to be expected, and we have to make space for that. I think there are when people lose their lives, not literally, but their homes and their possessions and their social network, because everything broke apart. Everyone ended in the diaspora somewhere. They don't necessarily always talk about it to their kids. The trauma is sometimes too big. So, and sometimes they're not there. We have definitely had people who said, I wish I could go now and talk to my grandparents, but they're no longer there, but there is something of that collective history, even if it's not personal, that is available to them, that, like Marina just said, restored. Not just for Palestinians. I had this incredible experience in Bristol presenting the project at a Palestinian museum. And the first person, we have a way of kind of projecting it that is a little bit a filmic experience and then showing the map. And the first question was this turned out South African, very young guy. And he said to me, you know, after apartheid ended, our neighborhood that we were living in what got developed. My parents got some money, but were kind of forced out of where they were. And my father always, always laments the old house. And I've always been critical of him. I've always teased him about it. He said, I'm going home from here. I'm calling my father and I'm apologizing to him. Just that experience, you know, he just gave him a sense of what it's like to lose something like that.
Which makes me wonder, has ever been a case where the current owners of those houses actually met previous owners? Has ever been the case where you were able to have families meeting each other without actually making any claims or anything, but just to talk about perhaps the memories of the same house?
We had one. There is a film by Sahira Dirbas from, I think, 2007. I'm blanking now on the title. It will come to me. Where she just went with the Palestinian owners and knocked on doors. And I think 5 or 6 or 7 people allowed them in, and there were very tense conversations. It wasn't exactly what we were trying to do. I think what wasn't exactly a surprise to me, but what became very evident was that mostly people wanted to talk about the good life they lost rather than about the loss itself. It was very important for Palestinians to kind of draw a very vivid picture of the life. So what we try to do with many of the projects is actually celebrate the life, not just the loss. But we did have one occurrence where we were able to walk in, and the woman allowed us in, but she argued that the British gave the house, this apartment, to her father because he fought in the Second World War. You know, it was impossible to convince her that that could have not been the case, because the woman standing in front of her was born in the room right there, right, in 1941 or something, you know. So and she also said something about, you have to put the past in the past or something like that. Yeah, there's a lot of trauma. We had a lot of trauma. Everyone had a lot of trauma. Let's just all get along, right? So yeah, I did have some Israelis who contacted me who really wanted to find the families. But I'm very careful about that. It's not always easy and not always a welcome request.
I can only imagine that. I'm interested very much in what you mentioned, the life lost. And I was wondering if, Marina, talking to your family, through your mother, your father, other, you know, the extended family, if you ever had the sense of what was lost when they had to move out?
But what was lost was the life that each of us expects, rightly or wrongly, to have in a place, in the place where they're born and live their lives. My family and all the other families I know expected to live out their lives in Jerusalem, to get married, to have children, just the regular life we all expect to have. And then something happens and shows us that life doesn't work that way. For example, a pandemic, as you know, we're in right now. It just, so it's really the life. And that's what I'm trying to capture through my blog. I'm trying to capture that life and in a way give it back to them since they couldn't live it out.
Sorry, you should really talk about, you know, specifically like your mother and her milieu. They were so independent in Jerusalem, and that independence was taken away from them later, right? It wasn't, they went from a very cosmopolitan city, riding bikes anywhere, doing whatever they wanted, getting an education, to a much more provincial place.
Yes, yes. And that's that interruption, the lifestyle, your everyday reality. And yes, what Dorit is referring to is, you know, yes, my mother and her friends, I mean, they were part of the Greek community of Jerusalem, which was probably the largest expatriate, if you like, community. They had a lot of independence. They, you know, my mother had boyfriends, you know. Her first boyfriend is the was the brother of one of our other participants, whose daughter now is my best friend. So we often kid with the children that we could have been brother and sister. Things that when they went to Cyprus, these things were unheard of. It was not allowed. They were not allowed to go out. Women in Cyprus at the time, of urban women of that society, were not allowed to go out and chaperoned. And there was my mother and her sisters and her cousins, and they had male friends, not necessarily boyfriends, and they go out on their bikes. And Cypriot society looked down on them a little bit as if they were, you know, slightly loose women, you know. So that was lost as well.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned, and Dorit used the key word, I mean, by 1948, Jerusalem was a cosmopolitan city comparable to many others around the world. And there was a character that was lost, and perhaps something just similar happened after 67, even though under different circumstances. And as many guests of the show mentioned, I mean, when you look around Jerusalem nowadays, yes, you have a lot of people speaking different languages, but the sense of a cosmopolitan life is not there. I mean, it might be confusing to think about cosmopolitanism as just people of different ethnicities or languages, but it was really the question of living the life, as Marina just mentioned. I mean, they had opportunities, which nowadays are not simply possible. And certainly between 48 and 67, they were separated. I want to ask both of you something about, again, the project, in a sense that in the last decade or so, there's been a proliferation. And I know these words may sound negative, but I don't think it's negative. But certainly there's been a number of projects dealing with the 3D reconstruction of a city, mapping of a city, collection of pictures and other material. Some do have you know, political goals, and this is very much in the open. Others are just really trying to recover the life. And my understanding is that Jerusalem, we are here, is really very much about recovering the life of a specific neighborhood within the context of the city. But how do you see these projects in the future? How do you think, and if you think so, these projects can actually help a process of reconciliations between people?
You know, the word peace and the word reconciliation have been overused so much. So I think what I would like to start with is justice and equality. So I think that we need political justice and we need economic justice for anything to be able to move forward with stability, with a future. Otherwise it will be unstable and there will always be trouble. To me, personally, I mean, the project didn't ask a political questions. And I think for some participants, even heavily involved participants, it was really just about making the past known. It's about the research and making it visible and accessible. To some people, it has a political, it makes political statements about the present and the future. And we didn't pose a kind of a condition or about that in participating. For me personally, as an Israeli Jew, the only way I see moving forward is with a binational state. That's just, I think that two states are, that possibility, if it ever existed, is long gone. So then when we think about sharing the space, we have to think about it both physically, and this neighborhood, which was affluent in 1948, has become a slum later because it was where refugees, very poor refugees, were brought first from the old city of Jerusalem. They were ultra-Orthodox, not highly prized by the Zionist secular government, stuck together into a bunch of apartments. Later, there were immigrants from the Arab world, Jewish immigrants from the Arab world, brought in. They would leave four or five families in one apartment, and people started kind of building sheds and blocking balconies. And slowly it has been gentrified. The neighborhood has been gentrified in two waves, in the 60s by Ashkenazi Jews that wanted nice, beautiful Palestinian homes, which they didn't call Palestinian homes, they called Arab homes. And for the past 20 years, the only people who can afford there are fairly rich American Jews or French Jews. So to me, we have to think about the space. We have to think about gentrification. We have to think about the others of Zionism, which are not only the Palestinians, it's also the Mizrahi Jew. Some are calling themselves Arab Jews. It's also the ultra-Orthodox Jews. Even though they have a certain political power now, they're very much on the margins of the Zionist Israeli state project. We also have to accept Islamization in Jerusalem. And so we have to actually think of the city quite differently. But without reparations and without the possibility for people, the option to return, and without the acknowledgement that the space should be, that was and is, and that Palestinians have a rights to it that could be realized in multiple ways, I don't think we're going anywhere. So for me, what I'm hoping is that in an indirect way, Jerusalem We're Here encourages people to start imagining what would it be like to share this space. You're virtually walking the street, and it's the way that the Google car shot it, filmed it in 2011 and 2012. But what you're hearing in the audio is sounds that were heard over the radio in the 1940s in Jerusalem, Palestine. This disconnect, this anachronism, to me, it's what we should aspire to kind of in the future. Whether art can do that, I don't know. And I really did not want to do a didactic project that says this is the solution, because I don't even know what the solution is. I think we just have to break away from the binaries of either or. And the either or has never been just two. It was never Palestinians and Israelis or Jews and Arabs. It's breaking down to so many more other groups, subgroups that And we need to learn, we need to look to the past in order to have a better future. We need to learn how to live together in ways that we have forgotten, I think.
I agree. I think it's important to look to the past. I think it's important for the purposes of acknowledgement, because without that, you don't have anything. But I also want to say that it can also be a little bit of a trap, because memory is not just about a place, it's also about a time. And if you rely too much on memory, you can disregard the fact that evolution would have happened regardless, and the places would have looked different regardless. If everything had resolved itself in a beautiful coexistence sort of way, the place would look totally different today. It would have been developed probably more, who knows? And it's easy to fall into that trap, to think that you're going, a lot of these websites that I'm, you know, I'm aware of what you're saying, there's a lot of them about Cyprus as well, and people reminisce, and it's fine. And I think it's useful both as an acknowledgement, as a memory, as a historical thing, but we forget that it's not just the place, it's also the time that we're missing, and that we will never recover.
I think this is a great image. It's not just the place, but it's the time really passing by. And I understand the sense of nostalgia. And, you know, when I look at these websites and pages, they're amazing. But we also have to be conscious of the fact that, again, I mean, you know, something else happened and nostalgia doesn't really help to bring back that. But it's good for the memory. And I think it's also good to recover the past. I'm a cynical historian, and I'm trying to get less and less cynical. That's why I've become sort of in favor of like browsing these websites and try to engage with these pictures from a different perspective. As I said, it's part of my sort of personal also career path. Dorit.
Yeah, I want to add to what Marina just said. I think one of the things that are probably, you asked earlier about reception, and one of the things that is hard for Israelis is to face the fact that they can't just say it was Arab and they left. You know, they, if they watch the project, it becomes actual people visiting their houses and they can't get in, or they can, or the house no longer exists, whatever. And one of the things that is difficult for Palestinians is that the streets are filmed as they are in 2011 and 2012, and time has marched on. And as Marina said, even if there was no Israel, even if it was Palestine, class that the class privilege that teachers and architects had of gardeners and drivers and all of that would probably not exist today. They might have had to split their own big houses into multiple units for their kids, or developers would come in and take over. So having to come to terms with the fact that we are at a different historical moment, and if we want to look forward, we have to accept where we're now before we think about it. And one of my experiences kind of privately, when I talk to people that I'm in touch with, families who participated that I'm in touch with, is that often the generation that lost the houses, they really want the rights back to that house. And the younger generation say, that's not my goal. My goal is to be an equal citizen with my right, obviously not necessarily an Israeli citizen, but in whatever confederation we have or whatever form we have, but to have the same rights. I want reparation, I want acknowledgement, I want all of that, but I don't need that particular house. More than that, I need a recognition that we should be equal politically. And so how do you nudge people towards that? And I think our structure, because so many of the films are not really about the past, they are about the present, encourages some of that. I hope.
I also want to thank you for mentioning a few information, a few things about Katamon post 1948, because that tends to be forgotten, particularly in the Israeli sort of national official narratives, where Katamon had become this point of receptions of all of the Jews, of many of the Jews coming from the Arab world, so Mizrahi Jews, mostly from Iraq, actually. You know, that is another narrative that gets lost, since it does not represent this sort of narrative of, you know, conquest and redemption as envisioned by the Zionists at that time. So I think this is an important element to mention, that Katamon also went through that transformation from an empty neighborhood to become a neighborhood that essentially welcomed refugees. But quite interestingly enough, because they were Arabs, and this is my personal view, they were not allowed to stay there, but they were then moved to villages, Bat Safafa and others. So then those houses, as you mentioned, were given back to elites. So I think there's also a class element here to remember, which I think is very important. Obviously, we're not going to explore here. We are moving towards the end of the interview, and I want to go back to where we started, to your Jerusalem. You know, we talked about the project, we talked about how the project works, and sort of the impact. But I want to talk about your Jerusalem, considering that I'm talking to you with different sort of origins. Dorita, Israeli Jewish, and Marina, Greek Orthodox, right? Am I right? Yes. Different kind of vision and experiences of Jerusalem. And my understanding is that, obviously, because of the different stories, you also went back to Jerusalem in different times. Dorit, you were born there. Marina, you went back in 1986. Can I ask you just briefly to reflect upon your personal experience of the city? And when you are walking around the city, if you have a place that is close to your heart, or a time that is close to you, what would that be?
For me, it's the neighborhoods where my mother and her family live their lives. I know that Jerusalem for everyone is the old city. It's the churches, it's the holy places. It's the museum side of the city, if you like. But for my mother and her community, it was a real city. It didn't matter that it was this city that was the patrimony of the world, as everybody calls it, right? It was their city. It's where they live their lives. And for me, those are the special places, those neighborhoods, the Greek club, the Regent Cinema, which today it's called Lev's Madar, but it's still there, the oldest running cinema in Jerusalem. That's what my Jerusalem is today.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think the neighborhood that I grew up in has become completely ultra-Orthodox, and I have no friends that stay there, and it has changed quite radically. And my connection now to Katamon and the German colony is very deep. I see it as a layered space. I don't see it just as it is now. I see it with all the pictures that we have in the project, with all the interactions I had with people, with all the stories I hear. So, you know, for me, like going to sit at Villa Dakan, which is now the nature museum, which is like the oldest nature museum you can imagine. It hasn't been changed since my childhood or before, with glass cases, with like, I don't know what stuff, you know, like dead animals. But the garden has really changed, and there is a community garden there that is incredible and very welcoming. And there are structures where you can, people like during COVID would come and pray on Saturday, because you could be covered but open to the elements. And, or being at the Hansen building, which used to be a lepers hospital from 1900 until the early 2000s, and now is an art center and has a cafe and a bar, and also amazing terrace garden, because it was a self-sufficient farm for the lepers. So those places have both history and present life in them that is very, very dear.
And if I can add something, when Dorit and I are in Jerusalem together, we navigate the place using the old place names. First of all, her parents' home is, as she said, in what used to be an old soccer field. And that's always a very welcoming place for me as a visitor. Her parents have always received me with open arms. And then as we walk around the area, we refer to places with their old names. For example, let's go down Zananiri, and then we can go, yeah, let's meet at the Greek club, or let's meet at the Regent. We use the old place names, and yet we're navigating the space today.
It's fascinating. I tried a couple of times to go around with old tourist guides. But as you mentioned earlier, a lot of streets have been changed, and, you know, new roads have been built. And yet it's still possible. I mean, there's certain parts of Jerusalem, and not just the old city. I mean, particularly Sheikh Jarrah is the kind of place that you can still navigate with a 19th century, late 19th century tourist guide. So, you know, history is still relevant. And I really want to thank you. So these were Dorit Naaman and Marina Parisinou of Jerusalem We Are Here project. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial free. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.